Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 167 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and to start the introduction of our co-hosts, here's David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hi, Max. Good to be back.
Well, good to have you back. And you've got a aviation history segment for us this episode, I hope, right?
Oh, was I supposed to do that?
Yes, you were.
I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, I guess I do.
Okay, good. Also with us is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog. Hi, Dan.
Hello, and good evening, Max and everyone. And as always, thank you for listening.
And also with us is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Oh, is it my turn now?
You're on, boy.
Oh, I see. Okay, yes. Well, good evening, everybody.
Our guest this episode is Kevin Garrison. Now, Kevin was last with us way back in episode 46, and he's one of those guys who has a resume that's so long he could take up an entire show just to recite it. So just briefly, Kevin's a writer with articles in AOPA Pilot, Smithsonian, Plane and Pilot, Airline Pilot, and a whole lot of others. And he's got a number of books that includes The CEO of the Cockpit, Flying Through Congested Airspace, Clear Left, Monday Sucks, So You're Dead, A Novice's Guide to Non-Being. I think that's an interesting sounding concept. We may have to talk about that. Kevin was also a 767 captain, and he's also flown a lot of GA stuff. So, Kevin, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, thank you, and thanks for, you know, motioning me over to the virtual couch to join the show. I feel like I'm on the Tonight Show. This is great. Thank you.
Oh, really happy to have you back. Now, is your latest book, is that the Complete Illustrated History of the United States Air Force? Is that your recent book?
Well, yes, it is. Yes, it is. I turned it in a little while back and got paid for it. And now the book is standing in line behind the Army book. And when they finish doing the Army book, we're going to start on the getting the Air Force book put together. It should be a little bit less than a year. I'm hoping in about 6 months it'll be out, because the money would be nice.
These things take such a long time, don't they?
They do. I've got to write a whole new history, you know, by the time it comes out.
You ready for the next one?
Yeah, we're ready for another whole new Air Force history. It's amazing, though. When I got to about World War II on this project, I was to the point where I thought I'd shoot myself if the Air Force did anything after 1946. And it turned out they did.
It
was a little difficult for me, but, you know, I'm not blaming them. So.
All right. Well, coming up, we've got so much stuff. I hope we don't forget anything. We've got the aviation news from the week. After the news, we'll spend some time with Kevin. As we mentioned, David has his This Week in Aviation History segment. And we have an Australia Desk report from Steve Isher and Grant McCarran. That's going to be kind of interesting. Stick around for that. And Peter Johnson is back with his Across the Pond segment covering European aviation. Plus, we have the winner of the Airport Spotting Guide for Europe contest, a bit more on grilling the geeks, and a little bit of listener mail. So why don't we get started with the aviation news?
Well, I'm really glad that you're really promoting the Australia Desk by calling it kind of interesting. I'm really glad we're promoting the hell out of that.
Yeah.
Gotta give I'm almost riveted.
All right. It'll be good, I promise. Our first story comes from Flight Global. Cargolux 747-8F delivery impasse ended. Delivery on October 12th. Qatar Airlines CEO Al Baker says the dispute between Cargolux, Boeing, and GE over a 2.7% fuel burn shortfall has been resolved. Now, why does Al Baker have anything to say about this, you ask? Well, Qatar is a 35% stakeholder in Cargolux, something I didn't know. I guess this is great news for Boeing, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's good to see this resolved with the issue with Cargolux and then having Atlas Air changing their order. So it's good to see this finally finishing up, and hopefully this is just one final bump for the 747-8.
Yeah, the article mentions that both GE and Boeing are working on what you call a performance improvement package, a PIP, that's designed to address not all of the fuel burn shortfall, but at least half of it. But that's not going to come online immediately. It'll be a little bit of a delay. So I mean, we don't know exactly how this was finally resolved amongst the parties, but at least they seem to be moving forward.
And I wonder if they were going to charge Cargolux to park their airplanes on the ramp at Seattle if they didn't take it.
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. Storage fee, right?
I wonder what it cost to park off 478. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's probably not cheap, but probably Cargolux is not going to see a bill for that from Boeing. All right, anything else on the 747-8 freighter?
Who will be the next company not to take the 747-8? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not taking any. I don't think I'm going to buy one now. I'm totally down on it. But is this actually I know it's a fuel problem, and I know almost 3% is a tremendous amount of fuel. Yeah. But is it also a cash flow problem maybe? I mean, I'm not into Air Qatar's books or who owns Cargolux, but it just seems kind of an odd bulk. And I wonder if they balked because they wanted I mean, the guy in the article denied that he was trying to get concessions on the 787 delivery mess up. But it just seems to me there's got to be more to this story than that. And I fully expect you guys to dig into it. So you should get tickets for Seattle right now.
Yeah. And hold on.
I think we talked about that last week, didn't we? I mean, didn't we say something about the fact that it was probably something about cash flow in there?
Maybe I kind of agree with Kevin.
I mean, I don't know Cargolux that well. But according to their website, it looks like they were profitable in 2010. If this was Qatar driving these negotiations, I believe Qatar only became a shareholder in Cargolux in the early days of September. So if they were the ones pushing this, you know, it could just be part of that. But I'm just, you know, speculating here.
Yeah, because the tone of the article, Al Bakar or whatever his name was, kind of acted like he was disgusted with the board of Cargolux, and I think he actually used the term mismanagement in there a couple times. So, you know, this may just be trying to whip people into shape or something. But
I will say that the CEO of Qatar, he is definitely one of the more outspoken airline leaders out there. So
yeah, and he's a pretty shrewd guy, I think, in that he will use his opinions to leverage things to his advantage. And so, I mean, Kevin, it's interesting that you raised the question about cash flow or something else. There may be some other aspects to this that just aren't in the press and maybe will never be in the press, things that are happening sort of in the background that are driving this. But I guess whatever they are, you know.
I just hope I haven't been in on the other episodes. So I just hope you guys haven't missed out on the obvious Air Qatar playing jokes that you could do with this.
Yeah. On a side note, I'd like to confirm that I will not be ordering the 747-8. My credit limit has I requested an increase in credit card limit, and it's just not happening.
Not going to work.
Kevin, you realize that Air Qatar thing went right over Dan's head.
I believe it did. Could someone explain this for me?
No,
I don't think so.
Instead, let's move on to the next story. This is from the Wall Street Journal. This is ruling favors U.S. Airways. So U.S. Airways Group says that the pilots have engaged in a work slowdown over about the last 6 months, and this has caused flight cancellations and delays. And the article shows us that a federal judge says that the pilots' union can't do that in an effort to pressure the company in contract negotiations. Now, the U.S. Airline Pilots Association union argues that no job action is taking place. Instead, they say U.S. Airways is pushing pilots to fly unsafe aircraft and is retaliating against aviators who raise legitimate concerns about safety.
Yeah, I mean, U.S. Airways and the pilots have always, the relationship's always been a little bit interesting, because it's just such a mess at this point. When U.S. Airways and America West merged, they were both represented by ALPA, so that was fine, that was cool, whatever, but eventually the pilots started fighting with each other over seniority, and then a new union was voted in, but that's USAPA, and that's a little bit more focused on the legacy U.S. Airways East pilots, and now it's just such a mess. So basically earlier this year, U.S. Airways alleged that USAPA, especially on the East Coast, and was engaged in a work slowdown, kind of masqueraded as a safety campaign. And they had some interesting statistics about pilot maintenance write-ups and about taxi times and some other statistics. So it's interesting to see that there's now this preliminary injunction against USAPA, and hopefully the pilots and the company can negotiate a contract eventually. But I honestly, you know, this whole thing is kind of disappointing, because you obviously want airline pilots to be safe. I don't think he disagrees with that, and it just bums me out when safety becomes a union negotiation tactic.
Have you noticed that there hasn't been any safety concerns raised by the West pilots? I mean, the old America West guys. It seems like it's only the East guys that have suddenly noticed all these safety concerns.
You know what?
I'm not saying they don't exist, but I mean, there's definitely a difference there between the two.
Yeah, I forget the exact stat on the maintenance write-offs, but I believe there was more of a jump in taxi times a few months ago, on especially out of Charlotte, and whereas Phoenix, I really don't think there was a change. So, I mean, obviously, the pilots have the right to reject the airplane, and if they feel it's unsafe, they shouldn't fly it, and that's good as a passenger.
We went through this at my airline, and I don't know if I ought to mention which airline I was with for 28 years, but we went through this, and of course, then they went bankrupt and reneged on our retirements right when I retired. But anyway, it's a thorny issue. You know, the big picture, in my view, is that with deregulation, and of course, that's so old, some of you may have not been born when it happened, but with deregulation, it kind of gave all the bargaining power to management at the companies. And I know people don't believe that, but I don't think you've ever seen a judge issue an injunction against a company favoring a pilot group.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting point.
It's always that, oh, you know, and before deregulation, the pilot group was protected by the regulations. Maybe to the detriment of business, I don't know. I mean, they always got a small raise at every contract, and small improvements were made pretty much at every contract in most carriers. But in today's environment, of course, everybody's mad at anybody else who they think makes more money than they do. Second of all, any judicial relief always goes to the company. And then the ultimate judicial relief when the company completely screws the pooch. Can I say that on this thing?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, has sex with the pooch. It's an astronaut term. Anyway, and again, I'm speaking as a pilot, not a management guy, because yeah, I liked flying and my parents were married. But almost any judicial relief always goes to the company, and the ultimate judicial relief is when the company screws everything up and then declares bankruptcy, and then any contracts, pensions, savings plans, lump sums, health care, vacation, sick leave, anything else you had as a pilot disappears at the stroke of a gavel. I mean, and then, so, you know, in one regard, it is bad if people take illegal job actions. I agree with that. And I've seen my share of captains I've flown with through the years when I was an engineer and a co-pilot who would loudly say, well, I control how much money this company spends, and then would point to the throttles, which is true, because pilots have been known to fly 727s with flaps down from New York to Boston.
Wow.
You know, and burn an extra 12,000 pounds of fuel. But on the other hand, as a pilot who was slightly burned by all this, I have to look at it and go, well, where do they get relief if the company won't negotiate with them because it's in the company's best interest to ignore them or to let them fight amongst themselves? I'm sure that was encouraged, because there's nothing more fun for management than to watch two pilot groups duke it out and destroy each other. Then, you know, what other relief do they have? They can either refuse to go to work by calling in sick.
Yeah.
They're legally not allowed to go on strike until all the requirements from railway labor are fulfilled, and the company will try to stop that at every gate. And anyway, I know that a lot of that's my opinion, and I'm really not anti-management, but I've kind of been through this, so I kind of feel for the guys, because it's a crappy situation. And I can't think of anything more damaging to pilot morale or company success than suing your own employee group.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
So anyway, I'll shut up.
And that was actually part of the reason, I think, Kevin, maybe you know something about this. I'm sure that Delta seems to have tread so carefully on getting those seniority issues worked out between the Delta guys and Delta people and the Northwest people prior to the merger, because they watched where U.S. Airways had gone.
Yeah, and after the bitterness I expressed earlier, I have to say, except for one management group, maybe one and a half management groups in the whole time I was there, the place was a dream to work for, and ALPA got along great with management and actually worked with them. Hmm. A lot of the things we came up with, crew scheduling procedures, the long call system, the short call system, maintenance, the way we did maintenance write-ups, the way we did block test flights, all that stuff was worked out in cooperation. It was only one or two management groups who weren't actually with the company but came in from like the banking industry or from other industries that kind of decided that it was more profitable to set the groups against each other.
The one thing I think that's a little bit different here is, I think some of these issues are really self-imposed by the pilots. I mean, you had these two ALPA groups, if the way I could be recalling this incorrectly, but who basically said, "Oh yeah, we'll agree on whatever seniority award is given. Oh wait, we don't like it. Let's start, you know, fighting with each other." You know, there's so much magic can do.
I agree, but you have to also look at the fact that, one, it's human nature to do that, and second, I don't think people realize how vitally important a seniority number is to a pilot. It can make hundreds of thousands of dollars of difference in your career. Just two or three numbers can make that difference, and usually what happens is the stronger company pilots feel entitled to a higher number because, after all, we were the survivors. We bought you, not the other way around. That's the attitude. And, of course, the other guys would kind of like to be senior too. They don't want to go from being a fairly senior captain to being a fairly senior co-pilot and taking a $60,000 a year cut in pay. Hmm. So, I mean, it's big money, and it's very emotional, and I'm trying to think. There's only been maybe a few times, and of course the ALPA experts out there are way more on this than me, but I can only think of a few times that a seniority-less integration went completely smoothly.
No, that's very fair, and I guess I agree on the I totally understand how seniority matters so much, but I guess that for me I only get that to a point in the sense that, yeah, seniority is really important, but now that this seniority dispute has just dragged on for so long, you're basically now stuck in this bankruptcy era contract and just delaying negotiating a contract with perhaps better pay rates for everybody.
Yeah, but of course the management won't negotiate with you and went to court to stop you from slowing down to make them negotiate with you. So you got, you know, who's the enemy here? And the other comment I'd make is, how long would you be willing to wait to get an extra $200,000 in your career? Would you wait an extra 3 months?
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
So, you know, yeah. I mean, it really is that important. 5 or 10 numbers, even in a big list, can make a fairly good monetary, can be the difference between being a 777 captain when you retire and being a 7-3 captain when you retire, perhaps,
yeah.
You know, so.
Hey. Yeah, I know. I mean, I understand. I just, I mean, at this point, it's been, last month it was 6 years, I think, since the merger happened, roughly. It'd be nice to get this done.
Oh, but do you think any of the U.S. Air pilots are even thinking about how this looks, you know, how this affects their brand, how this looks to passengers? And I haven't seen what the numbers have been for U.S. Air. Dan, maybe you or U.S. Airways. Perhaps you've tracked this. You know, has ridership gone down? Is it steadily going down? Is it just kind of dead in a place? Has it gone up at all? I don't know. I'd be curious.
I think U.S. Airways has done, like the rest of the industry, has survived the past couple of years pretty well. But I think what's key for U.S. Airways is over the past few years, they've really, really focused on operational performance. And showing that off to customers, whether it be on time, baggage, what have you. So to have some kind of pilot slowdown that's affecting it, that kind of hurts.
Yeah, I can tell you from all the ALPA meetings I've been to, and I never was an ALPA honcho, that public sentiment and public image to the pilot group, although we'd like for them to like us, is impossible to get in the first place. In the second place, it doesn't matter. As a pilot group, you're not negotiating with the public. You're negotiating with management. And if the public gets mad at you, that, you know, the whole idea of brand went out the window about 15 years ago when they stopped calling the employees their biggest assets and started talking to them like they were liabilities, and started, you know, well, we got to cut this group against that group. And I know that was all necessary, and we're not the only industry that went through that. Everybody's going through that now. But it's just, I think a lot of pilots may agree with me that getting the public to like us is a huge waste of time and money, because I've never heard of a case where the public would hold a demonstration and say, now you Northwest Airlines or you US Air, you give these pilots more money now because they're good boys.
Yeah, but I wasn't talking about the pilots being liked by the public. I guess I was thinking more in terms of how this entire conflict affects the way people look at U.S. Airways as a whole. I mean,
I agree. But then again, it's not really the pilot group's job to run public image and the brand. It's management's job. Mm. You know, if they want to, you know, polish the brand, they might want to negotiate with their pilots.
Interesting point.
Yeah.
All it takes is a table in a room, you know.
Yeah. And we've got plenty of those.
And a federal mediator, probably.
Sometimes, you know? Yeah. All right. Well, that's good. Interesting conversation. Let's move on a little bit to the next story. This is from Information Week. iPhone app can fly unmanned aircraft. So a Boeing engineer...
See, we don't need no stinking pilots.
That's right.
That's what U.S. Airways should do. Just fly their airplanes from their iPhones.
That's right. And that's what a Boeing engineer has done, who has flown a UAV over a baseball field on the MIT campus in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And you might say, okay, that's not such a big deal, except that this engineer was on his iPhone in the Seattle office. This is all through a Boeing project. It's called the Micro Aerial Vehicle Visualization of Unexplored Environments. Well, that's a mouthful. Yeah,
there's a federal grant for you, huh?
It rolls right off the tongue. It's MAVVUE, I guess. MAVVUE. I know, Kevin, I'm sure you must have some thoughts about the sort of the growing activity with respect to unmanned vehicles in the airspace.
Oh, yeah. It's cool because nobody's looking out the windows anyway. So at the flight levels, everybody's got sunscreens up. So, but I was intrigued by that because it would be so neat if you were an airline guy and you could fly your trip from home or from, you know, if you didn't like being home, from someplace you like being.
Yeah.
That would be nice. But another thing that occurred to me with the cell phone thing, I guess you need cell phone coverage for the one they have right now. I know they're not going to send guys to combat hoping they have enough bars to, you know, defend their hooch.
Yeah, hopefully not.
but I was wondering if they have one of those buddy sign-up things where you can sign up with a friend. I forget the carrier that had that. Could you sign up like Al-Qaeda as a friend and then bomb them for free?
Yeah.
It wouldn't cost you any minutes. You're right.
That's right.
I mean, that would be a great thing if somebody's running for Congress. They could put that in their platform and go, look, I've got a way we can bomb these dudes for free and get airline points to boot. You know?
Yeah. But here's my one question, though. As Rob, as an iPhone user, will know, just like myself, and actually I think David's on AT&T, right? Yeah. The network isn't exactly reliable. So –
No, hold on. It just the only real problem I've ever had with my phone was whatever they called it this year at Oshkosh 11. If there's going to be a demonstration team using their iPhones to fly airplanes at Oshkosh, that's going to be a big disaster unless they improve coverage. But for all intents and purposes, I can't complain about my cell phone service.
No, I have to agree with David. Occasionally my phone doesn't work very well when I'm at home, but like this at work, I've never really had a lot of trouble with mine. Dan, okay. do you know how to operate yours?
Yeah, well, hold on. Here's a question. Isn't your work like literally like 20 feet from your home? Really?
No, actually about 100. David, what would you say? Maybe 125 feet?
Yeah, I would say.
What does the court order say? probably 100 feet minimum, I'm guessing.
The dog comes with, that's all I know.
And how cool would it be if you were flying a UAV while on in flight with in-flight Wi-Fi?
And then Wi-Fi failed. I don't know, this is getting a little scary to me.
Yeah, I think we should all be drunk or stoned in a dorm room having this conversation, you know, while staring at the ceiling. Hey, man, did you ever notice God spelled backwards? You know, I guess that I'm not guessing. I've heard that the Air Force has a separate track for UAV pilots. Is that true, where they don't go to UPT and they just go to model airplane school?
You know, that's an interesting question. We have Mark Jones coming up here in a couple of weeks, who is an instructor down there in Texas at, what Air Force base is he at? I forgot, but he does a lot of primary training with pilots. It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that.
I've heard that that's true. I don't know if they start out in boot camp, like having to start their own 049 engines on cold mornings. Get that fuel on their fingers and get cold and then have the thing thwack them in the fingers. I mean, that would straighten their butts out. That'd make them tough. But anyway.
Did you fly RC back in the old days?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Kevin? No, I couldn't afford that. I had the one on the string, the PT-19
on the string.
Control
line.
That was put together with rubber bands, and then I'd get so dizzy I'd like pass out because the thing, you know, made you go in a circle until you dug a hole in the ground like a big drill.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I remember those days.
Mostly I was scared of the engine, so I didn't fly it much. The engine scared the crap out of me.
Yeah,
that's why I decided to become a pilot, not a mechanic. I wasn't smart enough to be a mechanic.
Our last story comes from Defense News. F-16 sale approved for Iraq? Really? Lockheed production until 2015. So, that's very interesting. David, are we selling F-16s to Iraq?
And believe it or not, we're selling new F-16s to Iraq. They're going to come off the line at Fort Worth and go to Iraq. And Iraq just put a down payment about $3.5 billion down for it. And now we're about to send... And Iraq wants actually 36, so they want a second set of 18.
Payment? Where do you think they got the money for that?
Well, the Foreign Military Assistance Program.
Okay.
I.e. us.
Us.
Okay, well, let's revise the story then. The United States government is generously giving them new F-16s so they can protect their own skies.
Mm. I guess that makes sense. Do they have qualified pilots? What was in their Air Force before,
MiGs?
MiGs.
Yeah. Actually, we blew them up.
Before 1991, Iraq was one of the most sophisticated air forces in the world. They had MiG-29s, Fencers. As far as Soviet products go, and French products, they were top of the line. I was fortunate enough at Oceana last week to see 85021, which is the triple MiG killer from Desert Storm, was still lurking around, now flying for Louisiana and the National Guard. But now we're going to give them brand new F-16s, which will make the 27th country in the world flying F-16s.
Hmm. Awesome. Now, did we include the built-in bombs with remote controls like we give to all the other countries?
I think the self-detonation devices go with them, yeah.
Awesome. And we can do that with an iPhone app, right?
Yeah, I knew that was one. I knew you were going to say that.
Well, no, actually, we don't want to use our quality iPhones. We're going to start using Androids for that process.
I see.
Okay. Yeah, I guess it depends on what kind of data plan, because you don't want to be charged for the extra data.
Right.
So, but that's interesting.
But to make interesting is the fact that Lockheed will be producing these to 2015. And in 2015, that means they will have been producing F-16s for 40-plus years.
Wow. Now, what about pilot training? Do they have pilots who are qualified to fly F-16s, or do we...
Not yet. Surprisingly, most of the F-16 training in the world is actually done by the United States in the Western United States. Eventually, if the plan goes through as it is right now, it is Holloman Air Force Base will become the worldwide trainer for F-16s. Currently, it's Hill Air Force Base in Utah. So we will train at least the initial batch of Iraqi pilots, just like we train the initial batch Iraqi pilots on C-130s.
Makes sense.
The C-130s are used. I happen to be very intimate with three of them because they came from my father's squadron here at Willow Grove. Hmm. When they retired in I-13th, they sent them over there. So one of the C-130s I had time in is now part of the Iraqi Air Force.
Wow. So, David, are there any other F-16 sales on the horizon, or is this the end of the line?
Oman is supposed to get 12 more, too. Huh. So, I mean, most of the Middle Eastern countries now, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Oman, UAE, Iraq, Pakistan. A lot of the Gulf countries will be flying F-16s for a very long time.
All right, before we close this out, Rob, you had something that you wanted to bring up on user fees, I believe.
Well, I think it's important that we mention that up on Jetwine.com, people that live in the United States have an opportunity to spend 30 whole seconds of their time to help make an impact on saving the aviation industry, because we are being faced, or we are faced right now with another ugly user fee situation here in the States, and we need people to write their members of Congress. And up on our site, we listed a couple of places that make it so easy that they could almost do it falling out of bed. But we need people to take action. It's easy. Please go up to jetwine.com, fill out the form that the links take you to, and send a note to Congress and tell them no user fees. Thank you.
And it's really easy. Did mine today, Rob.
There you go. There's your call to action. All right. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, guys.
Well, again, we're with Kevin Garrison. Kevin, your website is kevincreates.com, right?
Yes,
that's
it is.
That's where people
can find
all of your stuff. Kevin, do you have any big projects going on right now?
Any big projects? Boy, I had another outtake I was going to give you for that question, but no, actually, I'm kind of like the Orson Bean of the Geeks program here, because I really don't have anything to sell, you know, for my appearance here. I finally got around and joined the 20th century and put my books on Kindle.
Oh, really?
as we old folks say, on the interweb. And actually, for you authors out there, I know Robert's probably already glommed onto this, but you get like a 70% commission on those books, which is awesome. And so you can price them a little lower. And I'm actually selling quite a few that way. It's kind of given new life to those books. And I bought 2 or 3 six packs of beer with it. So I'm pretty excited. Yeah.
I'm planning on publishing all my adult novels that way.
Ah, that's lovely. I like that. That's great.
Yes.
And then the other thing I've been busy with, we have a thing, an organization called the Kentucky Institute of Aerospace Education, which appropriately enough is in Kentucky. And we have 16 high schools signed up now. We're going to have 20 by the end of this year. And the program primarily is kids doing stuff outside of school. It's not part of the school curriculum. It's addition to the school curriculum. But if they go through the whole 4 years and graduate, they walk away with a free AMP license and a free private pilot license.
Wow.
And
How does that work?
Well, they build their own aircraft through – are you familiar with Build a Plane with Lynn Freeman?
Right, yes.
Yeah. Okay. And we get airplanes through there. Right now we have 6 airplanes, but they've rebuilt 152 that I train them in. I volunteer my time and train the seniors. Last year we only had 4, and this year I think we'll have some more. We're going to actually start doing the flight training during the sunny, warmer months up here, because trying to flight train in wintertime up here is just a waste of everybody's time.
Mm.
And at any rate, we have a small hangar. We're getting ready to build a 100-by-140-foot hangar in Frankfort, Kentucky, the capital. And we've got the go-ahead for that. And the students start off taking classroom work, and we have an AI that oversees their mechanical work, so they can log all their mechanic time preparing for the AMP. And they pass their written in their senior in year and get their practicals out of the way. And in their senior year also, the ones that are still left in the flight program that are still interested in it, they take a series of orientation flights during their 4 years before they enter the flight program. We've been able, up through last year, to fund their training, which basically is just gas and insurance, because they built the airplane. And which is sometimes kind of daunting when it gets bumpy to think about. But and then my time, of course, is free. And so it's fairly inexpensive. And
for the students,
had a couple,
yeah.
Yeah, and quite honestly, out of the last year, this may be due to my poor instruction, I don't know, but we started with 4 students and 2 actually graduated with a license. They're at actually at North Dakota now, in that flight training program, mm-hmm. the University of North Dakota. But I think there's a lot of value in the fact that 2 of the kids decided that it wasn't for them. They started the year thinking, oh boy, I'm going to be a pilot and I'm going to go to college and take an aeronautical whatever degree. And for whatever reason, which I won't go into here because it's probably personal for them, they said, you know, this isn't really quite what I thought it was and I'm not as committed as they want me to be. And I'm going to move one of the 2 joined the Marine Corps. He's an aircraft mechanic in the Marine Corps. Well, he's in boot camp right now, but he's going to be an aircraft mechanic. And the other student is going to a regular college and getting a teaching degree because she decided that's really what mm-hmm. she wanted to do. But with the 20 schools, we're hoping right now 3 of the schools have flight training programs. They don't all have the same program. The central program that we run from Frankfurt does, but we're hoping to get there. That makes Kentucky really the only state in the union that has a program like that. So we're kind of proud of it. I've been spending a lot less time there than I wanted to this year, but that's kind of been the love of my life lately. I had so many people. I was just a PFC, a private, you know what, civilian coming up, and I had people help me, you know, that would hop in the plane and work with me on my commercial maneuvers or something like that. And, you know, I kind of came up that way, and I kind of felt like, Not like the movie Pay It Forward, but I kind of felt like I wanted to pass along some of this knowledge, you know.
Oh, sure.
You know, turn out more mediocre pilots, I guess. But no, the 2 kids that graduated are really sharp. But anyway, that's my what I've been doing, and writing. Not doing a lot of selling, but doing a lot of writing. And just kind of sitting here in my office with my dog.
It sounds great. It's kind of like what Rob does.
Yeah, except he's successful at it, you know, and I'm not so much.
Oh, I'm not sure of that.
But I'm having a great time. Ever since I retired, it's been great.
So, Kevin, of all the books that you've written, is there one that kind of stands out in your mind as your favorite or that gives you the most satisfaction?
Yeah, strangely enough, The CEO of the Cockpit, the last, it's kind of a collection of essays of the, I used to write a column for avweb.com called The CEO of the Cockpit. And I love doing it because I could do it. I kind of took on a voice of a crotchety old captain who was kind of just a mixture of all the crotchety old captains I ever flew with, including myself. And you could get away with a lot. And it amazed me when the column, it ran for 5 years, and we had quite a good readership. I think we had like 130,000 readers, and got almost that much hate mail because because people really got upset with this guy. And of course, they assumed it was me, and a lot of it was me probably, but yeah. I kind of used the fictional voice of a lot of crotchety captains. Talk about, you know, how grumpy I sounded earlier in the program. And people really got upset, and I think it's because people had an idealized idea of what airline crews were. Well, heck, you got Pan Am on TV now, you know. And anyway, I got a lot of mail about how dare I, you know, say that it's no fun to fly on Christmas, or how dare I say that I get kind of tired at night at 3 in the morning, you know, flying an all-nighter through bad weather. And I got a lot of good mail, but it surprised the vehemence of the anger from some people, because it kind of shattered their, you know, how dare you, you know, shatter my dream of, you know, flying a jet around. And it was like, you know, the years I did it, it was a wonderful, I wouldn't give up a day of it, but it was a job. Very often it was a job. You know, you showed up and the weather was bad and the company was mad at you because they thought you were slowing things down and, you know, so, but anyway, to answer a short question with a very long answer, and I apologize for the length, but yeah, that's been my favorite so far. I'm working on one now called Fly Like You Mean It. And now that I'm more of a general aviation geek, I'm doing a lot more general aviation work. And that's going to come out only as an ebook, and it should be out in a couple weeks. So kind of looking forward to that. Yeah. I had it come out for about 20 minutes, and a couple of my friends downloaded it and sent me an email. Oh, my God, you can't sell this. Only every third word spelled right, you know. Oh, no. So who knew you had to edit things? You know?
So what's the theme of the new book?
Well, the initial theme, the beginning of it, I kind of write that I'm a little angry with the world because we pilots, especially general aviation pilots, but every pilot I've ever met ends up at some point apologizing for being a pilot or apologizing for having an airplane or making fun of themselves for having an airplane or being a pilot. And then that always results in maybe the president saying, oh, you shouldn't fly in on your expensive private jet. We're going to get people who have expensive private jets. And I'm saying we should flaunt it. We should fly like we mean it. We should climb in a plane every day. Because Al-Qaeda can't do that without trying to kill somebody. You go to any country that's not free and see if they have people building airplanes in their basements.
Mm, yeah.
In America, we got thousands of people building airplanes in their basements. It's just a natural thing for us. And I'm getting, in my old crotchety old age, I'm getting a little tired of people apologizing. You always, at a party, you'll hear that. You know. Well, and the other thing that you hear, which I can understand because people try to sell general aviation as this amazingly safe, fun thing to do. So when people go, oh, is it hard to fly? The next word out of the pilot's mouth is, oh, no, it's really easy. It's just like driving a car. It's so easy to learn how to do and blah, blah, blah. Well, actually, no, doing it professionally is not that easy. It takes years of study and more years of experience and lots of dark nights and stormy days, mm-hmm. you know, and anyway. But then the book gets a little lighter after that. But the initial idea is, you know, let's stop apologizing and just start enjoying it. Because the best possible answer to the critics and the naysayers is to go out and just have a blast.
I love this. This is great. And so people can find this on your website, on kevincreates.com. That's where that's a good place to go.
Or the best place to look for the book coming out will be Amazon.com in the Kindle section. I'm going to launch it as a Kindle book. Okay. And all my other books are pretty strongly ensconced at Amazon.com, but you kind of have to go to the Kindle section to find it, okay. Or you can just look for it under my name.
And but, the title again?
It's going to be called Fly Like You Mean It.
I love
it. My other books, The CEO of the Cockpit and Clear Left, I'll have the chicken, which is kind of a throwback to the old co-pilot joke.
Yeah.
I know Robert gets it. Actually, that's been selling pretty good too, but it's for sale. And then my Halloween Afterlife book, So You're Dead, A Novice's Guide to Non-Being, is there too. And I'm going to start promoting. It's Halloween month, folks, so go and buy my it's just a book I wrote because I kind of got tired of reading all these books about how people would die and then they'd find out it was a mistake. Somebody invariably mm-hmm. comes out to them in heaven and says, sorry, we screwed up. We're sending you back. Oh, no, don't send me back. Yeah, we're sending you back. And not that I'm discounting it and saying that what they went through isn't true, but I started writing a parody of that kind of book, and I got about 20 pages into it, and then I realized I didn't have any rules to follow. Like, for example, where do you live in your afterlife? And I came up with the answer, well, you live in a dorm your first 5,000 years, so you can find a place to live. You know, is there a meal plan? is there laundry service? Well, you don't excrete anything, so you don't really need to do the laundry. You know, and anyway, I came up with a short book of different rules. When can you expect to meet God? When's your trial going to be? Because all the lawyers are already in hell, it's hard to get representation. you know, things like that. Yeah, and just kind of a fun little book. But
so you just refuse to slow down, it sounds like.
Well, if I did, I'd have to sue myself in federal court for slowing down and dragging my feet. But no, I'm not half as active as I put on. I spend a lot of time in the Lazy Boy doing my captain nap routine. So
perfect.
What kind of dog do you have?
A Pembroke Welsh Corgi named Chloe.
Ooh,
she's the love of my life. She's my old person dog, and my wife and I have had her for 5 years. And when I was sick years ago, a few years ago, she was really nice to have here. So. Yep, she herds the horses.
The wife or the dog?
Yes. Yes. Yes, yeah. Love of my life.
Correct
yes.
answer.
Yes, no, both.
Yeah,
they, my wife, somebody said of my wife once that she takes in strays. I think that explains why I'm still here. So.
Okay. All right, well, Kevin, it's been fantastic having you back on the show. We promise we won't wait so long before we ring you up again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
It's been fun. Thanks, Kevin.
Uh-huh. Take care.
And now with his This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian. This one should be good because David's had 2 weeks to work on this.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode Number 27, October 2nd through the 8th. October 2nd, 1941. Heini Dittmar would become the first man to fly 1,000 kilometers per hour, or 621 miles per hour. Dittmar was flying the ME-163A4 Comet, K-E-W-S-W. The 163 was a liquid-fuel rocket-propelled aircraft. It would take off and drop its main landing gear. The Flow, or Flea in German, as it was come to be called, was one of the most dangerous aircraft ever to go into combat. Not for its enemy, but for its pilots and ground crew. S-stoff and T-stoff, the fuels to power it, would blow up upon contact. They also were notorious for providing severe chemical burns. The aircraft was an excellent glider, which caused several to crash since the final approach was unpowered. The aircraft would fly even with the slightest updraft. The wheels would, when dropped off at takeoff, several times bounce back into the aircraft, causing it to crash. Sadly, the aircraft was classified at the time, and it wasn't until after the war that the record was broke, and Dittmar would finally get credit. October 3rd, 1967, William J. Pete Knight becomes the fastest pilot ever to fly. Knight flies the X-15A2 to a speed of 4,520 miles per hour, or 7,242 kilometers per hour, which is Mach 6.72. As of today, the record still stands, which means Knight could have traveled from LAX to JFK in 1.5 hours. That with delays of 2 hours at each end due to traffic and weather. Knight, who was a congressman from California, is one of only five people to earn their astronaut wings for flying an aircraft. For the ultimate trivia, Scaled Composites Carrier Aircraft's name is derived from combining the last names of fellow X-15 pilots Robert White with Knight, making it the White Knight. October 3rd, 1985, OV-104, the space shuttle Atlantis, is launched on her first flight into space. STS-51J would be a classified mission for the Department of Defense. Atlantis weighed 3.5 tons less than Columbia. The mission deployed DISCUS, or the DSCS, Defense Space Communication Systems. The flight lasted only 4 days and returned to Edwards Air Force Base on October 7th. The crew commander was Carol J. Bobko. Pilot was Ronald J. Grabe. Mission specialists were David C. Hilmers, Robert L. Stewart, and William A. Pales. October 7th, 1919, Albert Plessman forms KLM. This is now the oldest airline in the world, still flying under its original name. Plessman was the son of an egg trader and enlisted in the Netherlands Royal Air Corps in World War I. It would be a business arrangement with Anthony Fokker, who would lead to the creation of KLM. After World War II, Plessman would become president. The Boeing 777-200ER PH-BQA of KLM is named the Albert Plessman. So, Gulukka Fridaka KLM, which is Happy Birthday KLM. October 8th, 1939. The Royal Air Force scores its first victory over a German aircraft in World War II. A Lockheed Hudson Mark I shoots down a Dornier DO-18 flying boat on a patrol over Jutland. The Hudson was from Coastal Command's 220 Squadron. First flights that occurred through the week of October 2nd through October 8th. Scaled Composites, VSS Enterprise, October 5th, 2010. Its first unpowered free flight. Convair 440 Metropolitan, October 6, 1955. The McCoy and Gervage MiG-29 Fulcrum A, October 6, 1977. Bell Helicopters OH-58D Kiowa Warrior, October 6, 1986. Lear, the Learjet 23, October 7, 1963. Lear, the Learjet 45, October 7, 1996. And lastly, Boeing Helicopters AH-6I Little Bird, October 7, 2009. And that's the way it was. This is David M. Vanderhoof, the Airplane Geeks historian, signing out.
Very nice, David. Interesting stuff.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, October 2nd, 2011.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 167. Grant, what can we do this week that's different? What can we talk about? What do you reckon?
Oh, it's got to be something big. It's got to be something different. It's got to be something cool.
Oh, I've got one here. What about ACCC approves Qantas and American Airlines Alliance?
No, boring, boring, boring.
Boring, okay. Well, we might shelve that one for next week. I know. Here's something we haven't talked about for ages. Qantas and strikes. Oh, lots of strikes at Qantas.
Dude. Boring. Everyone's striking against Qantas at the moment. Oh, baggage handlers, TWU, rampies, the works.
Oh, dear. All right, then. Well, you pick one.
What about the Dreamliner coming to Australia?
Dreamliner. I tell you what, I've got a great story here. I'll give you a hint. Now, in fact,
we're not going to talk about the Lateliner? Okay.
Oh, the Lateliner. Okay, well, look, here. Have a guess at what... There's a big story this week. What if I play a little theme music just to get you in the mood?
Okay.
Have a guess.
Someone is waiting.
Oh, what goes up must come down. The Aussie dollar's dropping again.
Well, it is. Well, yes, but this is not a finance show, Grant. This is not a finance show.
Okay. Was it to do with round and round spinning wheel? Oh, the Ferris wheel.
Yes, Ferris wheel and not Ferris wheel, as I saw it quoted in some American media this week. Jeez.
Well, you know, they just got the accent wrong. But so it's not Ferris Bueller either, is it?
No, it's not Ferris
Bueller. Bueller, anyone, it's your wheel.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, actually, Grant, a lucky save here and lucky that there were no fatalities here, and an aircraft known as a Cheetah S-200. Now, I don't know much about that aircraft, but anyway, we'll move on from that.
It's it's actually an RAOS registered, technically an ultralight, under 600 kilos, two-place, side-by-side bubble canopy kind of aircraft. So it's like a light sport aircraft in the US. For us, it's an RAOS, Recreational Aviation of Australia.
Now, this is an aircraft, of course, flying into a Ferris wheel at a fair in the New South Wales mid-north coast town of Taree. Now, that's a couple of hundred k's north of Sydney. We're not really sure exactly what happens, and of course that will be subject of an Australian Transport Safety Bureau investigation, one would think. Very lucky that it didn't topple a Ferris wheel, and as I said before, very lucky there's been nothing more than a few injuries.
Yeah, apparently indications are at the moment that the two people on board were trying to land at the nearby little airstrip. There was a fair going on. They tried to land. They had to do an aborted landing, putting the power in to go around. Some people have said, based on some Google Earth assessment, that the Ferris wheel in question was about 180 meters from the runway and 45 meters off the center line, which sounds pretty drastic to me. I'd be surprised that they were allowed to put something like that so close. But yeah, apparently doing a go around, climbing up, going back around, And I guess with the nose high attitude, they just didn't see that the Ferris wheel was right under them. And smack, they hit it. Now, there were two kids of 9 and 13 who were on one of the carriages. Fortunately, not many other people on it. I think that there was no one else on the Ferris wheel. It did hit one of the carriages and get wedged in the Ferris wheel. So that saved the pilot and passenger on the LSA. The other two kids apparently kept very calm and were pretty cool throughout the whole situation. Took 3 hours to get the guys out of the LSA. Took about an hour to get the kids down via a cherry picker, but everyone down and okay. And yeah, obviously those Ferris wheels have got a pretty good lateral support, mate, because something around 600 kilos hitting it at about 50 knots, did pretty well.
Yeah, it did pretty well, although I notice here in a couple of the articles I'm reading here online that that will be a focus of the air safety investigation that will ensue, and they're going to look at why the Ferris wheel was in fact so close to the airstrip. And as you say, still pretty close. One would hope that they took the relevant safety precautions, and they're quite stringent when it comes to placing buildings and structures near runways. Let's just hope that, everything was legal there, and perhaps there was something else that went untoward.
Yeah, they were just very lucky that when they hit it, they got tangled up in it. Otherwise, that would have been a long ouch down to the ground.
Well, let's move on to talk about a subject that our historian will love us to talk about. Now, what's that, David?
If you're recording this, you're dead meat.
Yes, we're talking about tankers. And yes, in fact, we're talking here about the now former Royal Australian Air Force 707 tankers that have been retired now for a couple of years. Actually, Grant, I thought they'd actually all been disposed of and broken up, but it actually looks like that they're in storage, and actually they've been bought by the US company Omega Tanker.
That's right. They've decided that they'll pick up these ex-RAF 707s, and that are pretty old, but sitting at Richmond, somewhat mothballed. They're going to take them on and use them because they're finding there's a fair bit of work available for private tankers. But yeah, don't worry, folks. We won't make this a big one. This is actually good news. It's aircraft being returned into the tanking business. And yes, we won't talk any more about it, will we? No.
No, except that we might mention that the aircraft in question here, Alpha 20-623, 624, and 629, they've all been re-registered with US civilian registrations. And actually, -624 has been noted this week doing some engine run-ups. So interesting stuff. Those are quite old aircraft, in fact. But
Ex-Qantas.
Ex-Qantas, there you go. So good to see them back in the air, I guess. I knew that it would please you, David.
Yay!
I think he's still cowering under the microphone.
So there you go. We'll leave that one there. Now, just in response to the Gorilla Geeks question from last week, and one of the listeners there was talking about the Albuquerque box effect. Now, of course, as we all know, he says, sounding wise in retrospect, that's all to do with hot air ballooning. So, Grant, take it away and explain to the listeners what the Albuquerque box effect actually is.
Yes, that's right. When it comes to hot air, turn to Grant. Hang on, wait. But anyhow, the Albuquerque box effect. Basically, a box effect in ballooning is where you get winds going at about 180 degrees difference depending on height. You'll have winds going one direction, for instance, taking you towards the north. As you take off, you start heading towards the north, you have a nice flight, you rise up, can be 500 feet, 1,000 feet, can be a couple of thousand feet. You get into a layer of different air coming back the other way, and it will actually be taking you towards the south. So if you look at your flight path from the side, you go along, go up, come back, and then you can come back down, and sometimes you can land very close to where you took off. That's known as box winds. It's called flying a box, and in Albuquerque, that happens very often. In fact, they use that for the Albuquerque Balloon Fiesta. A lot of the crew will take off, fly towards Albuquerque, wave at everyone, go up, come back, and land again pretty close to where they took off. Very common in Albuquerque, thus the Albuquerque box effect. It does happen in other parts of the world, just not as common, not as reliable. You know, in fact, we have had it happen once here or twice here in Melbourne. I think it was every couple of years. I myself would love to get into this kind of flight because, you know, it's great. You can fly out, go up, come back, wave at everyone again, go out. Yeah,
I should have known better than to get him off on that tangent. Well, look, we'll just let Grant run with that. Until next week, I'm Steve Fisher, and that's Grant McHerron. Cheers, folks. Bye.
So, wait a minute. Now, I want to know how we come up with the idea for Grill the Geeks and they take advantage of it. Why is that?
Well, because we didn't know the answer.
So, I hope they send them buttons.
Oh,
I'm not sending anybody any buttons because those Aussies answered the question.
Do they have PCDU buttons?
I doubt it.
I certainly don't have one. All right, well, thanks to Steve and Grant for the Australia Desk Report.
That was yeah, thanks, Steve and Grant. Wow.
All right, now here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson, editor of Aerospace International and the man behind some of the most interesting yet amusing aviation tweets on Twitter. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. Good to be here again.
And we're also joined by Gareth Stringer, deputy editor of Global Aviation Resource and the voice behind Planes TV, as well as a familiar commentary voice at UK air shows. Welcome, Gareth.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. In this segment, we're normally going to have a look at aviation news stories. Tim, you were at a recent Astraea conference talking about UAVs. That's been a very topical subject recently, but flying in civil airspace.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's a pretty interesting conference on the progress in a UK initiative, £62 million. Initiative going on between government and industry to really unlock civil airspace for UAVs.
Yeah.
But the real thing is how do you do it safely? How do you introduce UAVs, drones, UAS? How do you get them into this airspace that has been built up over 100 years? You know, the system of ATC control, different airspace classifications. How do you do that sort of safely?
Yeah. And I mean, we don't have any airspace that's open to UAVs at the moment. I know the Americans have been having challenges with this, and with the recent strike of a UAV and a Hercules out in the desert, it doesn't bode very well.
Well, you can do it at the moment, but what you have to do is you have to put a big danger area around it, and you're basically blocking off a load of airspace for other users, so it's not very flexible. The easiest way, bizarrely, would be to treat it as an IFR airliner flight. You know, the pilot just isn't in the airliner, keeps to controlled airspace, flies on the airways, does the letdown. Most of the demand is going to be in the sort of uncontrolled Class G airspace. Points that really sort of struck me from our conference is, first is that it's interesting that there are a lot of positive things that UAVs are doing. You know, they're being used to save lives. They were first deployed in, you know, first thing was deployed to Haiti earthquake. It was a Global Hawk. Similarly with the Japanese tsunami, UAVs have been used there to look inside the reactor. So there's a lot of positive things about how they're actually sort of saving lives rather than being flying killer spy robots.
Tim, can I ask, just on that point, we're all aware of the military usage for these devices or whatever we want to call them. Are there lots of civilian applications? Are there people queuing up, be it sort of emergency services, even things like traffic control and such like that? Are there a lot of people waiting on these decisions?
Yeah, I think there are, because they sort of see it as, you know, there's people out there who don't want to have the expense of, you know, operating a helicopter.
Yeah.
But they still want to maybe, you know, monitor a bit of pipeline or some power line. So it's those kind of little kind of niche things there that be sort of really interesting.
Apaches and Chinooks, Gareth, been in the news for recently.
I mean, there was a documentary on Channel 4 here in the UK last night, which is the first one of a series called Fighting on the Frontline. And all the AV geeks like myself were watching it because it focused on the AH, the attack helicopter force, and also the SH, the support helicopter force, largely with the Chinook and the work they're carrying out in Afghanistan. Pretty sure you watched it, Tim, didn't you? I saw on Twitter some of it cut pretty close to the bone. It was quite shocking in places, which I think it was designed to do, not just in terms of the footage, and, you know, and we're talking about sort of legitimate targets, it has to be said, being you know, footage of those being people being taken out by the Apaches, but also injured people being evacuated on the MERT, the Chinooks from the danger zone back to hospital, but also other talking points, a sort of a gun cam session with the Apache pilots showing the ground crews what they were doing out in theater, a sort of morale boosting exercise. It was fascinating and quite different, I think, to any similar documentary that we've seen recently.
I think it was pretty, I mean, you're right, it was pretty brutal. And I think what came over there is one, there's a black humour of, you know, sort of squaddies on the front line. And the other thing that didn't really sort of touch on was that they, when I've talked to Apache pilots, you know, the strict rules of engagement they have, you know, it was kind of sort of hinted at. But, you know, the flip side of the kill TV, the gun cams, is that is evidence. If they go out there and they muck it up, and they make a mistake, you know, that is going to be in a courtroom and that's going to end their career, put them in prison. It's evidence there. It's not sort of glorifying it, but it's you know, learning lessons from it. And, you know, did we do this right? Yeah. Could we have done this better? You know, and is engaging always the right, you know, a solution?
Yeah,
absolutely. I have to say, we've worked with these guys at the website, but, you know, I've nothing but respect for the work they're carrying out. It certainly did give a different perspective on that sort of moral dilemma. And some of those, as you said, Tim, that sort of rule of engagement, the incredible rules of engagement they have to go through. Yeah. So, yeah, pretty extraordinary stuff.
On the civil side, we've seen some movement in Europe on airlines. Lufthansa is looking to divest itself of British Midland, and I think British Airways and IAG are interested in that. But our good friend Stelios, originator of the EasyJet business, is looking to start his own airline.
I mean, this is a extraordinary story, I think. Now, tell me if I'm, you know, was it just me or did this come completely out of the blue today? As I understand it, he is still a fairly large shareholder. In EasyJet, I think somewhere between 30 and 40%. There is a website which just says FastJet coming soon from Stelios. That is it. So far, in so much as we know, it's not an airline yet. It's just a website. Yeah. But EasyJet are probably understandably not particularly happy. But my question is: do we need another airline? Is there room for another airline? What's it going to do?
I can't see how another one can squeeze in. But knowing Stelios and his track record, who knows?
It's interesting because Stelios's falling out with the EasyJet board was because they were, you know, they were buying new aircraft, they were adding capacity, and he thought they should have been sort of retrenching and actually kind of digging in. And you know, they've kind of proved him wrong a little bit in that they have announced a dividend, they have announced that sort of traffic was going up, they've been boosted by, you know, business passengers. So quite where he's gone from, you know, you're adding too much capacity in a time when there's not not enough passengers to, I'm going to start my own airline. I'm not quite sure, but we'll keep a watching brief on that.
Yeah, definitely.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm RES, Tim R on Twitter, and we have a new Royal Aeronautical Society website that is www.aerosociety.com.
And Gareth, where can we find you online?
I'm Gareth_Stringer on Twitter, and you can find Global Aviation Resource at www.globalaviationresource.com.
Well, on that note, guys, I think we'll call it a day.
Fantastic, yeah. Great to be with you.
Thanks, Peter. Enjoyed it.
Excellent.
You can find Peter Johnson at Nascot Hornet and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com.
All right. Thank you, Peter. Now, two episodes ago in Across the Pond, Peter talked with Matt Fulkus about aircraft spotting in Europe, and Matt agreed to donate a copy of the new airport spotting guide for Europe to the listener who answered this question correctly. The question was, Europe has the world's busiest single runway airport. Which one is it? So we have a winner. That was Jasper Hoopman from Amsterdam, was selected from amongst the correct answers. And just a quiz. You guys know which airport this was, don't you?
I believe it's Gatwick, right?
Gatwick.
It's Gatwick.
Jasper gets the copy of the guide, so congratulations to him. All right, on to Grill the Geeks.
If you're hearing the Angry Birds, that means it's time for the newest feature here on the Airplane Geeks. We call this segment Grill the Geeks. Here's how it works. Each week, you, our faithful listeners, who obviously have nothing better to do with their free time anyway, or you probably wouldn't be listening to this show, will attempt to stump us with your questions. Will you be the one to stump David with a history question? Or possibly interrogate him with a yet undiscovered tanker query? Can you organize a seriously devious conundrum to catch Dan on an airline segment? Perhaps perplex Max on propulsion? Dare you try to challenge my bottomless pit of knowledge about air traffic control, business, or general aviation? Well, if you're ready for the ultimate test of wits, send your questions to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Each week, we'll randomly draw questions from those we receive. Unless, of course, you're the only person that week who had the nerves of steel needed to challenge us. And if you stump us, you'll win not one, but two official Airplane Geeks buttons. Buttons you can wear proudly around your local airport, proclaiming that you're obviously way smarter than we ever thought anyone who listened to this show could ever be. But if you're wrong, you must accept your fate, which will be decided on the show. So if you're ready to match us brain cell for brain cell, send those questions to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We'll be waiting.
All right. Over the course of the last week, we had a number of Grill the Geeks questions come in. So of all the submissions we had in, about half of them are for David and the other half are for, well, just all of us. So let's see. I can pick one that's for all of us. You guys ready?
So ready it hurts.
Okay. This is from Stuart. Stuart says, I spy with my eye a truly international airport. I can land in one country and be in another during rollout. Where am I? And if you need a hint, he sent a hint along also.
Yeah, hint would be good.
All right. If you need the hint is look along the U.S.-Canada border.
Niagara Falls.
They have an airport?
I don't know. It's just the first thing that came to my mind.
you mean Niagara Falls International Airport, which is right outside the falls?
Yeah, that Niagara Falls.
This is a GA question. Good luck.
Max, do you know the correct answer?
No, in fact, I don't. I have a guess, but I don't know if it's the correct answer. We're going to have to.
Well, then how will we ever know if anybody's right?
Stuart's going to have to tell us, I guess.
Let's go airport in both. Wait, so it's not the physical airport that's in both countries.
He says I can land in one country and be in another during rollout.
No. Oh.
Yeah, so it would be right on the line. It sounds like that's what he's saying.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Now, he does say rollout, but I could think of float out and it would qualify, which would be Vancouver.
Well, you know,
Seattle.
Vancouver was my guess.
Yeah. Do we mean the physical airport is in both countries or what?
I guess we're stumped.
Well, no, wait. Let's just see. I mean, we don't know that one of us was not right. Let's just check. I'm looking at something here about the Canadian boundary border.
Oh, this is entertaining. This is compelling podcasting.
Cross border airports. Here we go.
This
four airports that. Well, actually, this is kind of cheating because I looked it up and none of us are right.
Okay.
I'm finding something here that says Pine Creek Border Airport is in Manitoba and Minnesota. Cornokscobie Border Station Airport in Saskatchewan or Montana. Coots Ross International Airport in Coots, Alberta. And Sweet Grass, Montana.
Well, that must be it because he said it's an international airport.
Yes.
Is that the only one that's an international airport?
It's the only one that's labeled as an international airport. So I think he...
Give us that one again.
Coots Ross International Airport in Coots, Alberta, and Sweet Grass, Montana.
All right.
So that would be what I think is probably the correct answer. And I'd say, who is this guy, Stuart? Is this the guy from the show that was the little mouse that drove the car? Wasn't he Stuart something?
Oh,
that
was
Stuart. That was Stuart Little.
Oh, really? This is a different Stuart. Okay.
Okay. So
Stuart, I think you got us, buddy.
Send us your address.
Yeah, email us your address and we'll send you a couple of buttons.
Thanks to the others who sent in submissions. We're kind of just, you know, picking one random from this from the submissions. So
do we want to kill the Vanderhoof pile?
All right. Well, okay. So this is interesting. You won't know this, David.
Oh, come on. That's not fair. You know, I mean, I've watched this guy in action. He's right. Good.
Listen
he
to this.
He might know.
All right. This is from Gordon. Up until a wrecked Zero was found in a Hawaiian field, there was only one surviving aircraft that could definitively be placed in the air on the morning of December 7th, 1941. Can you name the type of aircraft?
Well, let's see. I know there was a fleet of B-17s scheduled to arrive at Hickam Airfield.
Nope, wasn't that.
Definitively in the air at the time of...
Right, of the attack on the morning of December 7th.
I think it was a P-40.
That was my next guess, but that wasn't in the air until after the attack.
It's not what you think.
Okay.
I mean, I was flying it, right? So.
Yeah, right. It was an Aeronca 65 TC Chief, NC-33768. It was rented to a father and son for a sightseeing flight.
Oh, that's right.
The aircraft accidentally found itself in the middle of a Japanese formation. Yeah.
If you watch Tora, it's in the movie.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah.
Do you know where that aircraft is now displayed?
Hickam Airfield in Hawaii. At the Pacific Aviation Museum?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. That I said it, yes, I do know where it is and what aircraft it was, yes.
By the way, that sounds like a really crappy father-son bonding experience.
Yeah, to end up in a Japanese attack.
Is that a bonding experience or a bombing experience?
Well, wow. You know what? Dan, actually, it could be quite the bonding experience. If you both feel like you're about to die, you're going to get really close to your dad real quick.
That is true. That is true. Wow.
Can I just add something to this Grill the Geeks concept? Do you have to make them so hard?
These are hard, aren't they?
Yeah.
We have some more hard ones, too.
I think these people are paying us back.
All right. Again, thanks to our other submitters for Grill the Geeks.
Yeah, good questions.
Yeah,
wow.
Good questions. We got some other good ones too, but we can't do them all, unfortunately.
Well, we can save them, huh?
We could save them. If you do want to send us a question, make sure you have in the subject Grill the Geeks. It helps if you put the answer in the email too, and I won't tell the guys what it is. If it's a question for me, I don't know.
You know what you could do? I think Steven did this. Email, question, separate email with the answer. Then we only open one.
Oh, boom. That's a great idea.
Problem solved.
All right, perfect idea. On to the listener mail. We got a lot of listener mail. Just want to mention quickly, Jeremy sent in some information about that Albuquerque box effect that Grant covered in the Oz Desk. And there's a Wikipedia link that describes it, and it's got some illustrations that are quite nice, and we'll put that in the show notes. So thanks to Jeremy for also helping us understand that effect.
And we're sending him some buttons, I think, aren't we?
If we like. Is that what we're going to do?
Well, it was a Grill the Geese question, so.
No, it's... it was a Grill the Geese question. You're right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, we are.
And we have
Jeremy.
To send one to Stuart. So you know what, we already covered that.
And whoever asked the Yaronka question,
right? Okay, let's see. We got a voicemail from Steven. He provides some more information on Boeing and Airbus customer codes that we talked about last time.
Good morning, geeks. It's Steven out in California, just walking into work at 5:01 a.m. Just listened to episode 166 and wanted to give a comment or two to follow up on one of the Grill the Geeks questions. To answer, to help with Dan's answer, the customer codes for Boeing, I believe, are handed out in order of new customers. So I believe it started with the 707, where I think Pan Am, their original airline code was... I think 11 or something like that. They were the 11th customer. American was the 22nd customer, 23rd customer to order a Boeing jet. Delta was the 32nd, Air Canada 33rd, JAL 46, SAS 83rd, and so on. And when it comes to the Airbus aircraft, I believe the last two digits in the designation are based on the engine choice. So, like a A320, 231, 232, 233 are all IAG engines or series, and the 211, 212, 214s are all CFM engines, or the, you know, the 11, 12, and 14 series for that. And it's the same, I believe, across the Airbus narrow bodies and wide bodies. So anyway, that's about it. Anything else you can... Feel free to ask me, and I can try to get you a better answer. But I believe the codes are in order for Boeing of new customers. And once they ran up to 99, they started with, I believe, A1. Or I think that was the first one after number 99 that they went to. So now they're all the way through JH. I don't even know how far down the alphabet they are. But that's how many new customers, whether it's been one order or 100 orders of airplanes. So anyway, have a good day, and I look forward to episode 167 next week. Take care.
Hey, thanks, Stephen, for that.
Our listeners are so smart.
Yes. Though, for the alphabet, I'm not sure how it works out, because it seems kind of, just as I'm looking through a list, it doesn't seem very scientific.
Maybe your expectations are too high.
Well, the numbers make sense, but...
Yeah.
So, like, I'm looking at the list, which, granted, this is... a Wikipedia page.
You're looking at the Boeing codes, right?
Yeah. So like Nippon Cargo Airlines is KZ, and then it jumps to ZB, which is Southern Air, and then ZG, which is V Australia. Hi, Stephen Grant. So.
And we also got an email from Luke, who corroborated Stephen's comments on the Airbus series too. He also gave some examples of the codes and how they relate to engines, either the CFM or the V2500. So.
I forgot.
And the
that,
bottom
so
the
you.
Bottom line is military designations are so much more simpler.
They are, aren't they? Jenny sent an email with a couple of questions, and we actually queried some past guests for the answers. Jenny's first question is, and you know, I've wondered about this myself, and she asks, why is it that as a passenger, the pilot's in-flight announcements are almost always incomprehensible? Do you guys find that? I do.
I know the answer to that.
You do? Well, we asked Carlene Pettit.
Oh, go. Oh, please. Okay. Let's hear what Carlene said.
Carlene said there were two possibilities. This was very interesting. This was really different than what I was expecting. But she said, the first possibility is they don't feel comfortable speaking to the passengers. Roger, heading 240 and cleared to land are more in their comfort zone. She says, I've commuted a great deal in my life, and there are some who like to gab, and they speak loud and clear. But volume goes down as a person's discomfort goes up. She says, I hadn't realized this discomfort until the last few months when some very senior captains and Czech airmen were having me make the PA. I then realized they don't like to do it. They make the first officers. Then the first officer mumbles through it. Interesting. So that's her first guess. And the second one is, she says, now there is another possibility. If it's not the pilot, but the system. She says, we on the Airbus, and she's an A330 pilot, we on the Airbus speak using the handset over the PA. But the Boeing, and I'm sure others, the PA system is normally operated through the audio control panel in conjunction with the pilot call panel. Thus, this could be a problem with the Clarity too. So that's kind of interesting. Those are her two comments on that. Did you have something different, Rob?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I think we go to Zara. And of course, we're going to...
When you were a pilot, did anybody know what you were talking about?
That's what I thought. Actually, I think the other possibility, as much as I don't want to disagree with Carlene, I think there's one third option that she failed to mention. And that's that the pilots really don't know where they are. And so they're trying to, you know, just get
through it.
Yeah, they're faking it. That's what they're doing. So no, actually, but I think most of the time when I say they're unintelligible, it's not that I can't understand the words as much as most of the time. It just seems like the noise level in the cabin is way louder than the volume of the PA system. So it just kind of gets lost. But I still think they really don't know where they're going, though.
Okay. Well, Jenny had a second question. Well, this was on airport design and passenger movements through the terminals and older travelers. She commented that...
Wait just a minute.
Rob, this ought to be
wait
right up here.
Just
your
a minute. Jenny, define older.
Well, she did baby boomers. She says, baby boomers now make up a large portion of the traveling public. Airport terminals are now more and more like an army assault course for us older citizens. We are less agile managing carry-on luggage, handbags, laptops, coats, etc. as we check in and as we try to negotiate security. And then she goes on to some other examples, which, you know, seem legitimate. So we asked Stephanie Gaiman for her thoughts coming from the airport perspective. She had some interesting tips. She said airport designs and new layouts don't occur very frequently. And when they do, it's off the end of a terminal's useful life or the airport population is outgrowing the bounds of the facility. All that being said, for elder passengers that are flying and having difficulty navigating and walking in the airport terminal, they can request wheelchair assistance from a SkyCap service or airline at the time they arrive at the airport or when they book a ticket. She says, another alternative at larger facilities with some airlines is to be driven with your luggage to the gate once beyond security via golf cart like transport. And she says, I'd recommend that any traveler, regardless of age, who is unfamiliar with the airport they're traversing, explore the public areas pre-security before even booking a ticket to become familiar with the terminal landscape. Once a ticket is purchased, allow plenty of pre-flight arrival time and don't be afraid to ask for assistance at any airport if you don't know your way around beyond security. And many airports offer two-scale terminal maps on their websites. And again, regardless of age, it's a good idea to study the map and plot your route ahead of time around the terminal. And finally, she says, if you can streamline what you pack to what you absolutely need for a trip and nothing more, you'll have less encumbrances in hand while navigating the terminal. So
yeah, tell that to my wife.
Why? Does she bring a lot of stuff with her?
Oh, my Lord. She brings enough for 9 people.
Oh. Also, we got a voicemail from Micah and also an email on the grand opening of the new terminal at Portland Westbrook Municipal. That's up in Portland, Maine. So Micah had some really interesting things to say about that new facility. He sent us along some photos as well. So I want to thank Micah for doing that.
But, you know, I think he had a very good comment to just, I know we're short on time, but he said he'd like to be the main man for the airplane geeks. And I didn't know if he meant the main man as
the main
in.
Man.
The main man. He wants to be our main man. You know, our our main man.
I got it. Now I got it.
Yeah.
I get it.
So, any case.
Okay, state of Maine.
Micah, you can be my main guy.
You should just stop talking now.
I should just stop. Yeah, okay.
All right, that's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening. Again, our guest this episode was Kevin Garrison. You can find out more about Kevin and his work at kevincreates.com. We want to be sure to thank Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk report. Also, Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment that covers European aviation. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. We'll start with David Vanderhoof.
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, and I had just posted some Oceania pics, so I'm going to get back to writing the blog.
Good, excellent. And you're going to have some interviews from that event in the future?
Hopefully. I got a really good interview from the Geico Skytypers. I hoped, as well as we still have my PAX interviews about UAVs and biofuels to talk about.
Excellent. And Dan Webb, where can people find you?
At the end of the rainbow.
Are we going to get some of those t-shirts?
With your unicorn, right?
Oh, yeah. Someone tweeted like a rainbow unicorn shirt just for me. So thanks.
It was fantastic.
Anyway. You can find my blog at thingsinthesky.com. Also, you can tweet me at Dan Webbage.
Excellent. And Rob Mark, where do people find you?
Well, they find us occasionally in the gutter, you know, with Dan Webb.
Yeah,
but no, just seriously, at our company site is comavia.com or at jetwine.com where we write the blog, or on Twitter at jetwine.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. I'm on Twitter as Max Flight. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com with links to the sites we mentioned in the podcast. This is episode 167. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And we also have a YouTube channel as well. Just look for Airplane Geeks, one word, on all of those. We're also on Stitcher.com where you can stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. Please feel free to send us an email. The address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Let's see. I think Bene Wilson might tell us where that is.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
Thank you, Bene. As always, opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find out all about him at www.brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
You stay classy.
Are you guys all ready?
Ready for what?
Ready to start. Ready to start.
Oh, right.
Wait a minute. I'm girding my loins over here. Wait a minute. Okay, go ahead.
You know, I never really knew what girding your loins meant, but I'm not.
Well,
maybe
I've got pictures. I'll send them to you.
Okay, great.
On a side note, I'm currently awaiting my performance improvement package for love. It's not come yet.
I'd ask you what the percentage shortfall is, but I'm afraid to.
It's the high double digits.
I see.
What about the military story? As usual, I'm blowing it, getting skipped over.
F-16s for sale.
It's in the Google Doc.
What military story?
It's been there the entire time.
Yeah, it
when,
was
when did
there.
That go in there?
Max, you know what? You got to start preparing a little better for these, buddy.
Just a quick note to Steve Vischer. You should probably snip out the piece where David said, "I'm very intimate with three of them," and use it at your leisure.
You know, I was thinking about that same thing, but...
By God, I love it. If they're killing each other, they should be doing it with our equipment that we sell them.
Oh, no.
Will that get in the...
Yeah, well, that may be an outtake. I don't know.
Yeah, that was my Milo Minder Binder moment. Sorry.
That's fine. On KLM, did you say egg trader?
Yes, his father was an egg trader.
Wow.
Instead of a tulip bulb salesman.
Yeah. All right, good. Thank you.
I was just going to say I'm glad nobody made any comments about people's sexuality there because you know we don't want anything about dykes in the show. So
really?
Oh, did you have to go and stick your thumb in it?
Really?
Okay, I'm very sorry if I offended Dan. I know is
I'm speechless.
Yes, okay, sorry.
You know, I mean, you're not the brightest bulb in the tulip bush.
I'm not laughing. Touché, I David. Am not laughing.
Do you want me to continue with the Dutch jokes? Because I'll be happy to.
No, I think that's quite enough.
Oh, no, tankers. It's only one letter difference from what? Oh, I guess I can't say that on the radio, can I?
What the hell is Cyloning?
You know what a Cylon is?
No. Oh my.
Battlestar Galactica?
I've never watched Battlestar.
Oh, you know what? What rock did you grow up under?
It's on my list. I've just never gotten to it.
Okay, wait. Let's tell him. David, let's tell him about the fix for Dan's microphone when it goes bad. First, Dan, unplug your microphone.
Right. And then nothing else.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, let's go on with the show.